Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Yeah, we did not, because, you know, since they were part of they were in probation and all that with the juveniles, and we didn't really have anything to do with them unless we were investigating them. And I was out of there pretty shortly after that, but never, you know, not able to track, you know, whether that was effective or not. Just don't know. But I do know, just watching them. Hey.
Well, let me ask you, after going through that, did you think about breaking the law after that?
No, I'm good. Nope. You know, I thought back to all the things I did as a juvie, you know, that might have been, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I think I went the right direction. Yeah.
Well, so you said you did that, you hurried because you had to, you know, you had paperwork to do at Pittsburgh. So how long did it take you from the time you applied to the time you got on Pittsburgh PD?
I would say it probably took close to about a year. Almost like with DEA. DEA was very methodical, very slow, and very good with the way that they hired you. But Pittsburgh police, yeah, but when it happened in a whirlwind. I waited about a year. When I went to take the test at Pittsburgh, I drove all the way from over in Western Ohio, so about a five-hour drive. Showed up, they had it at the convention center, you know, going back to when we're talking about how popular policing was, how difficult it was to break in. Went to go take the test. It was at the convention center. It looked like a Van Halen concert in 1984. There must have been probably close to, I think they said 18,000 people for 200 jobs. So, I took the test and didn't think anything was ever going to happen with that many. And being an out-of-towner, because, you know, there's a little bit of nepotism in some of those back east towns. But yeah, about a year. But boy, I'll tell you, you could tell they had a protocol in place to keep the out-of-towners out and to keep either the people who knew people inside or whatever, or to keep Pittsburghers. The gal calls me from Pittsburgh out of the clear blue, and she goes, you're considered for the job. You have 2.5 days to move here. And I'm all the way over by the Michigan border working, you know, over there. And I found out later on this gal had some issues with people so she had an issue with out-of-towners and some other things. She's a bit on the racist side. Let's just go ahead and say it what it is. This guy was very racist. And she said, you have 2.5 days to get here. And she says, this is what you have to have. Now, I'm an Ohioan. You have to have a driver's license, proof of residency, like a lease or a whatever. You have to have a telephone subscribed in your name and power. And you have 2.5 days to do it. But luckily for me, my secret weapon was my mom and dad lived within an hour of Pittsburgh. So I'm back that night. The next day we head up there, and luckily mom and dad were Uber before Uber was cool. They drove me all around Pittsburgh. Thank God I passed the test on the first try and didn't screw up any of the questions and what have you. But I passed the driver's license test. So I got my PA driver's license, end up finding an apartment, did everything in one day.
Wow.
End up having everything I needed in one day. And I totally baffled her. I could tell when I showed up at the public safety building with all my stuff, all my gear, you could tell she's very disappointed. Her name was Cookie. Anyway, yeah, I showed up and had it all. And so that's how it all went down. And it kind of bolstered what I thought too, when I went to the academy, because when you walk through the door of the Pittsburgh Police Academy, it's also very old. I mean, it smells like history when you walk in there. Old building, walked in, and there's this old disgruntled. This is my indoctrination into Pittsburgh police. I walk into the building, and you smell that history. I walk in, and there's this old pissed off cop sitting there. And he's like one of those, like the big city, old pissed off stereotype cops. He's got an unlit cigar chomped in his mouth and whatever. And he was he was very voluminous, big guy sitting there and just angry looking. And he had the tea sitting at a table. There was a container over here with nightsticks and a smaller container on the table with blackjacks. And if you're not familiar with blackjacks, for people out there, they were an impact weapon that was your backup if you couldn't use your full size nightstick, or once they went to asp, the expandable batons. But a blackjack was basically a leather wrapped about a foot long. It had a steel spring in the middle wrapped in leather. Had a handle and had a lead ball also wrapped in leather on the end. It's kind of springy. You could kind of give it some spring. And it was meant for close quarter stuff. So it was an old 1900 Keystone Cops blackjack, nightstick, and this pissed off old cop sitting there. And he says, name, sign here, get downstairs and get your uniform. And like I said, there was no friendliness. So I go down, I get into the locker room, and the first thing somebody said, and this is the first thing in Pittsburgh that anybody said to me from the PD, I get down there, and one of the other new recruits looks over at me, and he goes, "So who do you know?" And I'm like, uh-oh. I'm just that token out of town. I'm that token out of town kid and whatever. But I mean, that was really not a big deal. The rest of it wasn't nepotism or anything. That was the first thing it said. But you could see a degree of people that were there that had been, you know, that were like legacies or they had known somebody. But for the most part, it was a bunch of good guys and gals. And that carried on all through Pittsburgh. You know, I think a lot of the times for us, you know, we're our own best critics when it comes to not wanting a dirty cop, not wanting a bad cop, not even somebody that, you know, is even halfway like doesn't treat people the right way and whatever. I mean, most of us are our own best critics. And I can honestly say, like with Pittsburgh police, and I work the second worst part of Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh's north side. It's called Zone One. But all through my career in Pittsburgh, I met like maybe two or three guys that I'm like, oh boy, I wouldn't want to work with that fella. But that's out of hundreds of people. And we'd jump zones and go over to their zones to help them out. You know, we'd work special details like events and work with detectives. But yeah, no, my experience for the rest of the time with Pittsburgh was very, very good. It was truly a family. One of the biggest problems we had when you'd have a serious call where you had to call back up, like if you had a gunfight going on or you had like a really serious foot chase, one of the biggest problems was trying to sort out who all had showed up at your scene when you write your report. Because, you know, Pittsburgh had a whole bunch of agencies going on that were kind of like on top of each other. And even though Pittsburgh police was the clearinghouse for like a robbery or a shooting or what have you, you know, we had Allegheny County Police, Port Authority Police, Sheriff, School, and they could come back you up if necessary. And so it just looked like a carnival if you had like a really serious call. And so, and my experience was, though, that the people you work with were unbelievable. Yeah, never had a bad experience in the field. Very lucky.
Well, yeah, you had a bad experience in the field, weren't you? Didn't you tell us something about 2 weeks after you got released, you're out on your own? Didn't something happen?
So I guess we'll tell a couple of these for the first 2 weeks in Pittsburgh when you get out, they didn't have an FT, a field training officer program. When I tell people that, even 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I tell people, yeah, Pittsburgh didn't have a field training officer program. You'd graduate after your 6-month academy, and they're like, here's your badge, kid. Go out and do good. And that was the way they did it.
Wow.
So you had no FTO. You got a badge and a gun. Go get them, Tiger. But what they did do for your first 2 weeks is, for familiarization, they would put you in all the different – they don't call them precincts in Pittsburgh. They're called zones. But they would put you in a different zone in Pittsburgh for like a 3-day period. And that way, during the 2 weeks, you could experience every one of those zones, know where their stations are, if there's a court, whatever you need to know about. And you'd also do patrol work with another officer. And so my first week on the job, so many things happened in 1.5 weeks. It kind of like shows you the quantity over quality when it comes to, you know, street law enforcement in a big city. But I remember my very first call for service, I was in Zone 2, which is our downtown area. So that's the big sprawling downtown and then the Hill District. My first partner, he was an older guy, a little bit gruff and what have you. You could tell he's kind of like, he's not real happy being saddled up, you know, with the rookie, but that's what he had to do. And it was 9 o'clock or 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and they get a call of an unknown disturbance from Point State Park. Point State Park is where, if you look at Pittsburgh proper, you have two rivers called the Monongahela and the Allegheny River. They flow together and form the Ohio River. Well, right there where that point is, they have a really, really nice park right there. It's huge, absolutely huge. But nothing ever happens there, usually, because you can't escape. It'd be like Snake Plissken trying to get out of New York or whatever. You can't get out of there. So it's unusual to have that call. So we get down there. We just drive right through the park in the patrol car, right down through the green lines. We get down to where the problem was a park bench. And there were several business people, couple ladies, couple guys dressed very nice. And they're kind of standing back, just like watching this poor thing unfold. It looked like it was a homeless guy. He had that Obi-Wan Kenobi homeless look to him with all the like multiple layers of clothes where you can't really tell what's going on. And so he's laying on the, I don't know if it's a he, but found out later on the hard way. We found out the hard way. It was he. So he's laying on the park bench. And he's kind of like in the fetal position, but you can't see anything but like that Obi-Wan Kenobi wrap going on. Nothing. Can't see hands, but he's in it looks like, to me as a young, brand new, fresh out of the box, fresh-faced kid, I'm thinking this guy is going into convulsions. And he's making the sound that's like, grr. I mean, he's making these like animalistic sounds. He's in convulsions. And so I'm just kind of like, huh. And this cop, without skipping a beat that I'm with, old-timer guy, he gets out his big old micarta nightstick. He goes over in front of all these business people, takes it and just jams it right into the area that's probably going to be this guy's sternum or, you know, ribs or stomach or whatever. And just, he doesn't hit him with it. He just sticks it in there to give him a little, you know, hey, prod. He sticks it. Well, the guy never misses a beat. He stops for like maybe a second. Like he stops the convulsing and the gurgling sounds. And then he goes right back at it again into the convulsions. And I'm like, oh man, this is my first day. And this is going on. And these business people are like all shocked. They're like, oh my God, you know, because of the nightstick. And my cop, he goes dirt and jams the guy again. He goes, hey, I said, get the F out of here right now. And the guy stops making the gurgling sounds and then sits up. And now you can see it's a dude, but he's dirty. His face is really, really dirty. And his robes and whatever he had going on comes open. And there's no easy way to put this. I'm going to make the sound effect. If you heard that sound effect, that's what fell out of his robes.
Oh.
He had this thing that looked, it didn't look right. You know, when you see something that doesn't make sense to you, and just for like maybe a 2 second period, your head is trying to figure this, like, what am I looking at? I don't even know what I'm looking at, but you know what you're looking at. This guy had a monster dog. I guess this is, yeah, he had a monster dog. And he had been performing fellatio on himself.
Oh!
And I'll be honest with you guys. Oh. I'll be honest with you guys. You know, I've told this story ever since from Pittsburgh on. Like when you're sitting in a surveillance van, you're like, what's the weirdest thing you ever saw? Or like, or what's the most thing that ever made you most jealous? Anything like that. But yeah, so before we did our podcast today, yesterday, I just wanted to see, I want to make sure that I haven't misremembered this story. So I went online and I typed it in. Don't look at my browser for this one. I typed in, can a man perform fellatio on himself? And you know what? I was totally justified in telling the story the way it is, because according to Men's Health, and hey, you know, if Men's Health says it can't be wrong. 0.2% of the male population in America can actually do that to themselves. So, you know, you don't have to break a rib, I guess. You don't have to do anything weird. You're like a fetishist type thing. But anyway, so that guy sits up.
Oh.
I know. It makes a lot of mental. It you can't help but just get
I'm
the
sorry,
mental
but
images.
But if you do that, yeah. Does it? Do you? Are you automatically gay then? I mean, how does that work?
I don't, you know what? I'm not here to judge. I'm not here to judge. All I can tell you is, I'd have to say I would probably be homeless too. You know, if I had that going on, I might be homeless or at least never leaving my house. I don't know. But yeah, so that comes out and flops down and what have you. And, the business people and not just the men, I mean, not just the women. The men too. It was like, you know, those 1950s movie screams,
yeah.
Like the over the top, like from all the old horror movies, like, ah! that's what universally happened to that small little crowd of business people. They were nowhere to be seen in about 25 seconds. They were gone and whatever. And you know, the guy, the park bench guy, he reels it in, or I'm not sure how that spools it up. I'm not sure what he did to, or, you know, if he had a holster, I'm not sure what he did, but anyway, yeah, so he gets it back in there somehow and gets himself bundled back up, and he just goes trudging off. And he never did say one like word that you could understand. It was all just like, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just total nonsensical, you know, gibberish. And he just kind of wandered off into the sunset. I guess that's what heroes do.
Oh,
but yeah, he wandered off into the sunset, and I'm thinking to myself, huh? I went through 5 years of college and 7 years of military, and here we are. It's great. It was absolutely great. I would not trade my time with the things we saw in Pittsburgh.
I got to tell you, for the stories we've heard, didn't see that one coming.
Nope. I was thinking about we're getting to Seattle now.
Is this one going to air? Is this story even going to air?
Oh, yes, it is. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
This is going down. This is going to go down.
The names of the innocent will be, yeah.
I'm just sitting here trying to decide which one of you two is the worst. I don't know. It's up for grabs right now.
Murph, we're all products of our environment, you know? Was it nature, not nurture, or whatever?
I got you, man. I got you.
But to shift into a cop gear, though, like that same week, I mean, it was like training week as far as like the stuff that you compact in. One of my other calls for service, I went over the north side for a day, and I was on a night shift. And this is the one where, you know, it's glad it makes you a cop on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to being able to help people. The call was a bar, unknown disturbance. We get to this really ratty bar on the north side. I mean, it was really bad. We go in there, and it's an old Korean War veteran, and he was a regular there. The people all knew him and whatever. And he's a happy drunk, happiest to be older fella, and he'd just peed all over himself drunk. His pants had fallen down to the ground. So he's basically sitting on the bar stool with his pants around his ankles, no underwear on, wet all around him. And he had no way to get home. And so I was the young guy. I would have done it anyway. So I helped him get his pants up, pee everywhere, just pee everywhere. And this is before we all had, everybody's wearing gloves, and you didn't want to get on your leather gloves. I helped him get his pants up, and we got him home, got him into his bed. This is back when cops could still do that. You know, took him home, got him up two flights of stairs to his thing, and got him put into bed, made sure he was good to go, rolled over, called a family member. They came, and we left. But yeah, you went from you know, low gear to high gear. The next day, and these streets are where this happened is a really unique name, especially for back east. It's called the Mexican War Streets. It's in the north side, very dark, very kind of a dangerous part of the north side. But Mexican War Streets, there again, first week on the job, we're doing foot patrol, and a guy had beaten his girlfriend with a ball bat and had taken off. Well, there we are in the street. It was a veteran officer, real tall guy, and then two of us shrimpo brand new guys. And lo and behold, even though that street is very, very dark, the one street light that's really lit up, we see the guy running about probably a block and a half away. So we start chasing it. And like I've always been a runner, even like my little short midget legs. We take off after him. We're closing on him. And then like it's dark, dingy. About a third of the buildings in this area are abandoned. And they're weird because it's like a neutron bomb hit. You can walk into them. The people are all gone. But like the infrastructure is still there. There might be still TVs sitting on a stand. We found a full barbershop in the basement of one with the chairs, everything still there. Like the guy had just went and left everything there. But anyway, this guy runs into an abandoned house, and we go in, we clear, there's a basement. So we had one of my partners watch that basement. We cleared the rest of this two-story house. He wasn't there. He could have gone out the back door is blocked. So he's down in that basement. We call for backup, and there'd been a homicide. There's all kinds of things going on in the zone. They're completely backed up. SWAT was on a call across town, so they couldn't come. So it was us. It was your army of three. And we even called for canine support. No canine support available. So now we're standing there. This isn't going to solve itself. And so being young and stupid, we had our lights off, pitch black in this house. And we got to look at the steps. I saw what they were. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to stinger light in one hand. And my handgun in the other hand, I'm just going to just stand. So our plan was, let's stand here for about five. We already warned the guy we're going to send a canine, and that didn't convince him to come up or do anything. So I said, let's just stand here for about 10 or 15 minutes and make no sound at all. And then F it. I'm going to bum rush down those steps with no light and fall down the ground and hope for the best and see if we can, where this guy is. I know it's terrible tactics, but you know, when you're young and dumb and whatever, and it's like, we can't be here all night.
Well, the truth is that's what happens a lot of times.
So we stand there for 10 or 15 minutes to the point where this guy's probably wondering what the hell is going on, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, I knew I had the steps in my head. I had to memorize how they went. And they're fairly steep too, for those old school steps. I step onto the first step. No problem. I'm going down those steps like right now, like the second or third step just breaks, rotted. And the best laid plans, man. Yep. I went down there again. Sounds like somebody, you know, like a bad Looney Tunes cartoon sound effect. Doo-doo-doo-doo. I get down the steps. Boom. I land on the floor is a typical like abandoned house with just like plaster falling off from the ceilings. It's all wet and moist and centipedes and bullshit. But luckily for me, the way I fell was on my side, handgun still ready to go. Stinger, like when you train with your hand, with your light over your forearm with your gun so you can aim, back before the days when you had weapons mounted lights. And when I turned that light on, because it was as black as the center of the earth, turned that light on, and there was a suspect, and he's deer in the headlights, eyes are, I mean, like saucers with me. And he had a 38 special, and it was stainless, so it was glowing. 38 special pointing at the ceiling. And right as I had shined that light on him, the cartridges were falling and hitting the ground. He, in his head, he thought that if I don't get caught with a loaded gun, it'll be better for me. Even though you can't do anything, the gun's going to be there when we get you. The rounds are going to be on the floor right next to you and whatever. But that's what kept him from getting shot is, I mean, you can see the cartridges like hitting the ground and falling to the ground is he's like that hitting the ejector rod. And so, and he did everything he should have done. I pointed in on him. He did what he's supposed to do. We arrested him and no problems. That was all. you know, all within the first week of
I got to tell you, the real Rambo would have only needed a knife. That's all he would have needed. He just would have tied a little strip around his bandana around his head.
He needs a rope and a piece of canvas also.
That's all. That's yeah. Get your uniform going. Well, hey, because eventually you do make it to DEA after all this fun. So how long were you on Pittsburgh before the Fed bug finally caught up with you? And when did you start applying for the feds? And then third part, what made you pick DEA? Because you had a lot of FBI influence early on.
Yeah. So what I did the shotgun method during that time frame because how hard it was to get into everything. I kind of did the what I consider like the big three. Well, to me, the big three. It might not be the big three to some, but I chose FBI, DEA, and Marshals because I, you know, my alma mater for my internship. And I loved Marshal Service. But yeah, so I applied to them when I applied to Pittsburgh. So I'd waited a long time. And I think there was somebody else on either on your show or what have you, or maybe Murph, it was you. Somebody had said that they thought that their application had probably expired by the time they got the call. And that was the case with me. I was about ready to have to start reapplying, I think. But yeah, so I'd applied for everybody all at once, including Pittsburgh police. But yeah, so I'm in Pittsburgh and the DEA process started. And I will tell you that it was never lost on me, even when I got to Quantico. I felt to be privileged beyond belief. I know walking the halls of Quantico as a brand new basing agent trainee, there wasn't a day that didn't go by that I walked around Quantico because we trained and lived with FBI back in our day. We didn't have a separate academy. We stayed there at FBI proper, but never lost. I mean, I couldn't believe I was there. I mean, I was very humbled. But nevertheless, DEA, the process started, I think it was my almost third year of Pittsburgh Police. And, the process starts, and they were very methodical, and it was just very, very professional. I mean, it was impressive compared to Pittsburgh how they did their shenanigans. So I start through the process of DEA with the interview, and then going down that road. And I knew I was towards the end of the DEA process. I think the only thing I had left to do was the background check and what have you. And I think I had a doctor's physical, and I think there was one more thing after that. And so, but I get a call from the Marshal Service and they're like, hey, can you come interview with us? And like I said, with DEA, it was like months and months and months of this and that and what have you. They're like, yeah, can you be here tomorrow? And I'm like, yeah, would you like me to come to the federal building? I mean, and they're like, no, we need you to come to DC. And I'm like, well, and, DC is about a five and a half hour drive on the turnpike from Pittsburgh. But you never know. DEA might have a hiring freeze. You know, you're in the middle of it and now you're waiting another 2 years. So you take what you can get and then, you can roll it over if you need to. But my good old dad, he was down with a sickness to go on a little road trip. So he came up from Ohio that evening and then we just took off and we got over to DC. I will tell you that it's intimidating because Marshal Service, like DEA back in the day, they had their headquarters looking down onto the Pentagon. So there's another, kind of younger guy interviewing. I'm sitting in the waiting room looking down at the Pentagon. I'm like, wow, I'm in the big leagues. So did the interview, get done. And they're like, yeah, when you can get your physical? I'm like, you tell me. And they're like, how about tomorrow? So I have to get back to Pittsburgh. Well, it just happened my DEA physical was the same day. So the irony of this was all that time that I'd waited to go federal. And now my doctor's physicals for both Marshal Service and DEA are going to be on the same day. And so I will just tell the funny part of it. The DEA physical was conducted at a real honest to God, like a contract doctor. I mean, it was like professional.
You mean as opposed to the Army physicals where you came in, they said, bend over, cough. Okay, you got a heartbeat. Good. You're clear. Next.
That was it. Yeah, the DEA physical was actually pretty in-depth.
Wait a minute.
It was refreshing compared to that.
You want to qualify what you mean by in-depth? Was that the...
Or refreshing?
Was that the prostate exam?
As I recall, the other reason I could appreciate the DEA physical is because the gal, it was a female doctor, and she had, luckily for me, she had the whole geisha girl, tiny, tiny little, pinkies going on. So none of the big, meat hook army thing, like experience at the MEP center in Cleveland. But yeah, so in the morning I had that physical with DEA, and it was a thorough physical. And so now I'm thinking I'm going to go to this Marshal Service physical looking like a intravenous drug using, whatever between what they did downstairs with bloop and then with the needle marks. I know they always had trouble finding my, finding my veins to be able to do the blood test and all that. And so I look like I have track marks on my arm from that. So I'm going to go into this other physical looking like I've been around the block a couple times. But so the funny thing, though, is I get down there and the Marshal Service physical is down at the federal building, and it's with Federal Occupational Health. Well, their equipment is what you expect for a lot of the older government, you know, companies. They have really old stuff. And so I go in there, and the lady who was my, it was a nurse that took care of the whole thing. And she was an older lady, kind of gruff and whatever, but I was in uniform when I walked in. So I had to go right to duty from Pittsburgh. And you could tell we had a rapport going on. I liked her and we're joking around. So we start down the road. The funny part is I go to get my hearing test. And my hearing has always been kind of like the one thing I worried about getting into.
What'd you say? What's that? What'd you say?
You want me to push the button? I do a little button push every time you do a little.
This is the time you raise your finger to him.
I'm going to try to time it. I'm going to do with you just like I did that test. I'm going to just time it and try to be like another one bites the dust.
You just hit it a bunch of times hoping that the law of averages will work out for you. Yeah, I think I heard
something. That's pretty much it. What do you call it, like spray and pray or something like that? But the Army didn't do me any favors when it came to being a combat engineer because half the time, I mean, all you had maybe was foamies, the little foamy. You could probably file a lot of lawsuits on that one or whatever. So if you're lucky, and we were blowing up thousands of pounds of explosive. Like I was in Central America on an operation down there, and we're blowing up like half of Hiroshima megatonnage when we do quarry shots. But anyway, my hearing was not like it was there. It was good. I passed the DEA one with the professional equipment. But yeah, so I go into the marshal's one and she puts me in that little booth where you can hear everything but what you need to hear. I'm hearing my heartbeat. I'm hearing some tinnitus. I think I heard the heating system for the building. And she starts doing the test. And I am failing, tragically failing. Because I can see her out the window. And the first time she's like, let's start this over again. She does that twice. And then she starts getting the eye roll going and whatever. But she also looks like she's very sympathetic, like she's feeling really bad for me. And so after about, I don't know how many times we did it. And I know she's retired by now, so she's not going to get in trouble. I would say we're about four or five deep into the retries. And finally, she just says, let's try this one last time. And she gives me the all-knowing look with the eye like, watch me. And I'm like, what? And so I'm looking at her. And then she starts doing, you can't see me on the podcast, but she starts doing the old blink once. Blink once if you hear it. I'm not going to blink twice, but when I blink once, you're hearing it. And so that's how the rest of that test went. And I passed swimmingly. I did swimmingly on that one with a little bit of help from my friend. And so that was how I passed the marshal service.
Well, and for your blood, for your blood test, they just punched you in the nose, right?
That pretty much, yeah, yeah.
Bleed here, yeah. Pee here, sign here. Let's go. Get out.
That's it. But it was a whirlwind after that. They conducted their background check like fast. Like DEA took, I think, probably close to a month or two to finally, you know, get it done. But Marshal Service, I think it took like 2.5 or 3 weeks. And they were done with the background check. And the next thing you know, I have an academy date down at Fletsy, down in Glencoe, Georgia. And it was off to the races.
Wow. So what did you do?
So I get to Fletsy.
Let's back up for a second. So you end up on DEA later, but you start off as a U.S. Marshal?
Correct. Yeah. So I get down to Fletsy, and they have a two-part program when you're going to be a deputy U.S. Marshal. You go through the criminal investigative phase, which is you may have other people in your class from other disciplines, like from Customs Service or from, you know, different other federal agencies that go to Fletsy. And then after you pass that the original criminal investigative phase, then you go to marshal school, which is the last phase of your thing. Our class had all marshals, so we were going to be all together through the whole thing. So I get down there. I go through about a month and a half. We're just about ready to break over into marshal school from criminal investigative phase. That made me class president. I don't know how that happened, but they made the little short, angry guy class president. Class president, and then I get the phone call from DEA, and they said, "Hey, we know where you are, but we thought we'd reach out, let you know that we have a, you know, class date coming up, and whatever, are you interested?" And so I didn't want to be a douche, you know, so I said, "Well, can I have like at least a day or two to think about it?" And they're like, "Yeah, just call us back." And the gal was really nice. I mean, very nice. And so I went to see my coordinator, and he was cool. We went out the parking lot to talk about it, and I said, "What do you think?" You know, and he's like, I don't even know why we're having this discussion. This is an older deputy marshal that they bring back for the academy, kind of like DEA. They bring back veteran agents to help be instructors and to be class coordinators and all that. He's like, I don't even know why you have to even ask me that question. He goes, I would have done that about if I would have been, out of here rolling about probably 15 minutes ago. And, but yeah, so we go to, I make the decision to do it. And so I let DEA know that we're going to go talk to the class, the guy who's like, I don't know if he had been like a chief deputy. I'm not sure what the rank structure was for Fletsy, for like the head marshal in charge of the training, but it was that guy. All I can tell you about that fella, Like I said, I've met very few people in my career that rubbed me the wrong way or didn't seem like, you know, like you were brothers, sisters or whatever. But you could tell this guy was a corporate hack, like one of those ones that joins for the wrong reasons and whatever. He had that perfect, first of all, he had that perfectly sculpted face that looks like, in the hair that looks like something from like Mad Men or like that, like a 1950s businessman that has that Johnny Square Jaw thing going on. Very formal, very, very douchey, this guy. We go in there and he's got the smile that you know he's not smiling at you. I mean, even though we tell him what we're going to do and that we need to go ahead and change over from Marshalls to DEA, he smiles, but you can tell it's venom. Like he's like pissed. It's going to cause him paperwork or something. And he goes, well, then let's make that call. So we called DEA and we talked to that gal. And I wish I could remember her name, but I can't. I think I heard her name several years ago. Other people said she was like an angel walking the earth. Anyway, we call her and I talked to her on the phone for a second and then give her over to that guy. It wasn't speakerphone. He had a thing.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This guy, even though he's smiling, wants to cut me off in the middle of a pay period. And like, because we were like, right when this is happening, I still had one more week on the, like, before the next pay period came, before you could, and the way that it should have translated was, you get to the end of the pay period, and then that paperwork goes in, and then you go seamlessly to the DEA. It doesn't affect your retirement or leave or anything like that. That's the right thing to do. That's the good thing to do. And to back up a step, I'd even told that man, the guy who's being the douche, and my coordinator, hey, listen, I'll stay here for that last week and I'll be a janitor. I'll clean hallways. I do dishes, windows, whatever. I don't want to be that guy that leaves out of here. I said, so, you know, whatever it takes to be able to stay on there, I'm happy to do whatever, you know, grunt work you need done. Now, that wasn't good enough for him. He was just pissed off that this is happening. So he's talking to her on the phone. You can see that he's like, he's pissed, but he's trying to maintain. And finally he goes, she wants to talk to you. So she comes back on the phone. And this is where I realize, you know, I'm joining a really cool, this, I mean, I've been in cool agencies. This is going to be the, like the ultra cool. She goes, that guy you're talking to, fuck him. And I'm like, what? This is, I guess before it's like her, there was like very formal, you know, very proper English, like I almost like spotted tea, sir. Spotty. I mean, it was, you know, and, she's like, fuck that. She goes, you know what? Fuck that guy. She goes, you don't owe him anything. Get your gear and leave. Walk out right now, get in your car and leave Fletsy. She goes, I've got some things I've got to do to make this right, but I'm going to do them. Don't worry about being on their roster. You are now a DEA basic agent trainee. You're on our payroll. You don't owe them anything. Get out of there. Drive home. We'll see you in 4 weeks.
Wow.
And so that's how, and my coordinator, we walked out of there and he was like, that guy was pretty cool or whatever. And yeah, you could tell he wasn't real happy with that administrator. But anyway, yeah, left out of there and had a little break and then right off
the train. So your Marshall's career was, what, 2.5 months long, 2.5 weeks long? I mean, I'm losing track. Very,
I would say
very, very, very brief.
Yeah, you did more time as a Marshall's intern than you did as a deputy Marshal.
That's a real Marshall.
I really did. I had more action. I definitely had more action as an intern. I didn't see a single Whitsack shotgun anywhere in criminal investigative phase.
Yeah, well, yeah. What class were you in at Quantico?
I was in BA 112, which I thought was pretty funny because in the Army, that was my basic training company.
I was about to say 112, yeah.
Yeah, and then when I was in the Ohio Army National Guard, there was 112 Combat Engineer Battalion. So just, I can't play the lottery. I probably should have played that number, probably the numbers with that number. But it ended up being BA 112.
What were you, Murph?
53.
Hell, you're, damn, you're old. I didn't realize that.
53rd.
Jeez.
As us. Well, hey. I was looking at some pictures here. Were you by any chance in the academy when the actors from Narcos were there?
I was not.
Okay. I can't remember what class number it was. I got a picture of the guy that plays me is Boyd Holbrook, and he was, the class was carrying the flag for Don Ware. I don't know if that, I can't tell.
Gotcha. What. Our flag, we were carrying our flag for a gal named Carrie Lenz, who had been killed in the Oklahoma City in the bombing in that Murrah building.
Murrah Federal building.
But yeah, so if it helps, Murph, we graduated. It would have been in like May of 97.
Okay. Yeah. No.
Like, you know, May of 1997.
Actually, you know what? I got called and it was a little bit later in 97 to come up and be a class coordinator. And I had trials. I had a lot of trials lined up and you know, called, tried to get out of it. And they thought it was a scam. And, you know, the chief operations got to call down and talk to the RAC and find out about it. But what I didn't know is that the SAC for Atlanta was planning to promote me. I got promoted in early 98. I moved down to Atlanta. So, or otherwise, I'd have probably been up there the same time you were.
Well, Murph, I can tell you, you weren't a math major, because I'm just going to point out something to you. So, when were you in the academy, Rick?
97.
When was Narcos film, Murph?
I know. It hit me a while ago when I said that. I haven't had a lot of sleep in the last few days. I've been in San Diego. No.
You're about 20 years off there, pal.
Well, you know, I've got my socks. It's cold here today. I got my socks on. I've only got 10 digits I can use to count on.
Okay, back to our
hey, there's no shame in day drinking. I mean, yeah.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah. Well, let's talk now about DEA career, because I don't want to say your career got started off with a bang, but it literally did. It got started off with a bang. You're 2 weeks into your Pittsburgh thing, and you get, you know, Donkey Dong, you know, King Kong, you know, but you know, 2 weeks into your job on DEA, man, you face something that nobody wants to face, but it ended up happening to you.
Yeah, so it was about the week to second week, and so actually in DEA we do have an FT, we call it an F-field training agent, and so when you first come out of the academy. For about a 2 month period, month and a half, 2 month period, you have an FTA, and a lot of it for us, I think, in the beginning wasn't so much to be able to be an operator as far as tactically or being an investigator or what have you. A lot of it was because it's just weaving your way through the federal system, learning all the paperwork for doing your casework, how the courts work. A lot of the things is that the administrative part of DEA is a huge part of that FTA program. But nevertheless, you have an FTA that kind of hangs out, makes sure you're doing. He checks a lot. He or she will check a lot of blocks off for your tactics. If you you try to get a couple undercovers in so they can grade you on that, and make sure you're good to go. All the aspects of being a DEA agent is what your FTA looks at within about a 2 month period, and they grade you on that. So I had I had an excellent field training agent. His name was Brett. He was a former U.S. Army Green Beret, 5th Group, unbelievable gentleman. Unbelievable operator. He's the guy you wanted with you. And also he was my size. Nice to have somebody who's actually as short as me that I could pal up with. So, but he was my guy. I was done with the FTA program, and like my first case out of probation, had a funny beginning. There was a cocaine trafficker in Yakima. It was a gal, kind of a rotund gal, very, found out later on, very jovial, very funny. I think one of the things that kind of lends itself to is that you learn that there are all different types of, when you say bad guys, you have people that are truly evil, and you have the ones that, you know, just want to make money. They would never hurt you or your family and whatever. This gal was one of those ones that, you know, except for the fact that she'd done that, you could probably almost been friends with her. She's very, very funny, not malevolent, whatever. But yeah, kind of a rotund gal, jovial. She agrees to deliver 2 kilos of cocaine over to Seattle out of Yakima. And what she didn't know is that she's delivering it to the parking garage of the district of the division office.
You gotta love it.
Our Seattle DEA office it looked like a professional, almost like Art Deco building. It was very cool looking. It had a big Tolly's coffee in the bottom of it, and it looked like every other building over on Queen Anne's Hill. Very cool looking business type. It didn't look like DEA. And so she agrees to go there, and even the parking garage guys, like a regular contract, like with a smart little uniform and whatever, with like Acme or what have you. And so, yeah, she agrees to deliver 2 kilos of cocaine into the parking garage. She thinks the person she's dealing with is a business type dude. And she delivers it over there. The guard lets her in. She goes into the deep, dark bowels. It's like 5 stories down or something. There's like multiple gates. Gets down there, and boom, it happens. And she has a gun on her.
Oh.
She had a little handgun on her. Never pulled it. I mean, she gave it up so sweet right out of the gates. And she agrees to cooperate right away. And so she ends up being my first CS. And right out of the gates, she says, you know what? We can do a guy who's capable of anywhere from 2 to 5 pounds of meth. And it turned out the guy was a Mexican national. It was funny because, you know, I know we're going to be talking about shooting, but I'll just go ahead and describe the guy right now. You know, when you first start this job, you think of everybody that you're ever going to have to go up against. It's going to be really like bad news. Like, we're going to gunfight him. It's going to be a fight to the death. Him trying to get my gun on, you know, rolling around in an alley somewhere is like one of those old time tough looking guys, somebody capable looking. This guy that we're going up against, this foreign national, he looked like if Prince was Hispanic, and even slighter than how, you know, Prince was a very small man. This guy actually looked like a kind of like a Mexican version of Prince, had a little pencil thin mustache, very slight looking, very small guy. On the phone would do undercover calls, very effeminate voice. I mean, very effeminate voice, not the guy you think is going to go for the gold. So we get this guy to deliver, if 2.5 pounds is enough for me at this point for what we're going to do with this guy. So we get him to do 2.5 pounds of meth. We've done like 2 or 3 4-ounce buys, 6-ounce buys. So we've done a couple other buys. We go to do the final one. Well, we use a house that had been in before, that should have been in before. And we were able to get access to this house and he felt comfortable there. And so he comes to the house. This house has furniture and everything else is where he's been before and what have you. So he comes, and the way it was going to work was she was going to meet him in this living room, not a very big living room. Be in the living room. He's going to show her the dope. They're going to take a look at it real quick, give it a quick look at. And then to get her out of that room, because we knew this guy carried guns. He bragged to her every time, whatever he had showed her, that he carried 2 guns. Had a Beretta and a little like Lorsen 380, like a really crappy little, you know, one of those little crappy little Lorsens, or not a real good gun, but still a little hideout gun. So she's going to leave the room to get the money. And then we're going to come around the corner and we're fully decked out. And I mean, you guys probably remember this from your younger days. When you first start with an agency and you do tactical operations, you're dressed to the way everything you have is like black back then, black DEA everywhere, helmet, the whole thing. As you get older in your career, what could possibly happen? Next thing you know, you're down to your body armor and like a bandolier with your ammunition and a ball cap. I mean, with whatever on it. But, back in the early days for me, you wore everything. So it looked like something of a Matrix. But yeah, so we're all dressed up. We're in the next room over waiting for this all to happen. And he does. He comes. He shows that you can hear the wrappers and everything on the table. And then my gal gets up exactly what she's supposed to do. She goes, "Let me get the money." She leaves the room and goes back into a back bedroom. And we give her the time to get back there. And she even followed through, even though she didn't have to, because we heard it, with the page that she's going to give us. It's like, "I'm clear. You're good to go." She does the page and followed instructions perfectly. So I'm the first one out the door of the bedroom. The guy immediately behind me who opened the door was a fellow named Jake, former Border Patrol guy, big, tall farm kid. Jake spoke fluent Spanish. He'd been Border Patrol before. He's yelling everything you need to yell. You know, Montes Arriba, Cuesta, say whatever. He's throwing it all down. This guy gets it all. As we come out the door, I come around the corner and I'm carrying a little sawed-off, little Remington 870, like Wilson scattergun technology shotguns that we had. Back then, I don't know who made them, but they were a short, little, nice little shotgun. Come around the corner. Well, I'd loaded up with deer slugs. I had the first 3 rounds were deer slugs, and the last 3 were buckshot. The reason being, the way that room was, we couldn't move it around, and I was afraid he was going to die for cover behind a couch, and I'd have to shoot through that couch, and the buckshot wouldn't have been the right tool for tool for the day. So slugs. But yeah, no, I got a hand to that guy. I mean, he knew who we were. I came around the corner with DEA all over me. We'd already said police, a quest to say whatever, all that. And yeah, he comes off the couch with a Beretta cocked, and he has it to about belly button level coming up with it. And I mean, the door's over here and he's not looking at the door. He's not looking to get out. He's looking to gunfight. And I remember I was around the corner. I had 1 foot off the ground when I didn't have both feet on the ground. But yeah, pushed a trigger on that shotgun and sent a deer slug right through his chest. And it did exactly what you'd expect a 12-gauge slug to do. It hit him. It knocked him down so fast that, when you pump a shotgun under duress, it's fast. I didn't even have that shotgun pumped all the way back to being back on target again. And he's already laying with his head towards us, on his back, feet away from us. And he's doing that nerve thing where your arms make the jerky movements or whatever and what have you. So, but, no matter, people always ask, aren't these things scary? They happen very quickly. You don't have time, especially with the training. This is what you do. I mean, some people are different, but I know most of the people I've worked with, you don't get amped up, whatever. But so everything stops for 1 minute. Brett Parr, who was my field training guy, former Green Beret guy, he comes around me. He had a Colt submachine gun. I had the 12 gauge. We stop. There's gun smoke in the air. There's a tiny little laser beam of light coming through a crack. We had the blinds drawn in that living room, but there's a little laser beam of light coming down through a little laser show coming through that little beam of light. There's our suspect on the ground laying there hit with a 12 gauge slug in the chest, and everything was dead quiet after that shotgun going off in the house. Dead quiet. I don't think anything really skewed as far as time. Like a lot of times when you get into a critical incident, time either stretches or something weird happens or your hearing isn't right. As I recall, it wasn't a whole lot of that. It seemed like real time, but we still stopped for a couple seconds. And during that couple seconds outside, like I said, dead quiet, you hear from outside the house, ching, 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 ching. an ice cream truck pulls up. Of all the places in Yakima, Washington, that an ice cream truck could pull up
to track
the minute that there's a shooting. Yeah. Wow. And so the thing is, though, we had one close in surveillance unit, and the rest of the guys were all sitting way back. It's like, yeah, Hispanic male in an ice cream truck. Was this guy coming to back his play? I mean, who knows? Back his play? Maybe he's going to be the money guy where he leaves in the ice cream truck with the money. I mean, you just don't know. But yeah, but there's that. And you hear the ice cream truck, you know, happy ching-ching music out there and what have you. So that can sit for a second. The guy's staying in the truck. We come up on our guy. We look down. I mean, when you can see carpet through somebody, and it was that, I remember that 1970s, like that lime green, like burnt orange shag carpet. When you can see carpet through somebody, you know that you probably used the right round to end a gunfight. And Brett was one of his specialties, you know, like with Green Berets, they have two. When you're on an ODA or what have you, on a team, operational team, the Green Berets, they usually are like, they have like two specialties, like one's a primary, like weapons, and then the second one's medic or communications and medic or engineer and whatever. Brett's primary was medic. And this guy ultimately didn't make it, but he survived that minute basically because Brett took an entire beach towel and shoved it into the guy. But so we get that. Got the guns off the guy. And then we didn't want the other team coming in since we're already fully operational to go check this guy out. And we're armed up with long arms and everything else. So this guy secured on the ground. We got the gun secured. And then we let the team outside know we're coming out to deal with the guy in the ice cream truck. So we storm out that door, and that poor guy, he was just an ice cream truck driver. He had nothing to do with it, but we couldn't treat him that way. So we come out there, we get him out of the truck. We got him on the ground. This poor guy's scared. And he was just an ice cream truck driver that pulled up at the wrong house on the wrong day. In the aftermath, I think everybody's bought him out. I mean, I think everybody that showed up on the scene, all the uniform cops and whatever, I think that guy went home with no ice cream that day, from everybody feeling bad for him. But, so that was the first shooting.
Well, just to let you know, we did a story on You Can't Make This Shit Up, and it was a lady in a ice cream truck selling meth. So it does happen. We do have
an ice truck.
Yeah, an ice truck. So, but
that's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. We had a gal when we were doing you know patrol work in Pittsburgh in that real bad neighborhood for a couple of weeks. We watched her in a wheelchair in a place she shouldn't have been. She's an older lady, very very or very very big and whatever, in a wheelchair on a corner that's like a gang type corner and whatever. So we started watching her from an abandoned house. She was selling crack cocaine out of her wheelchair, like a Pez dispenser, how you open that little lid on a Pez dispenser and it gives you like a little chiclet looking thing and you can eat it and you put the head back down. She had her wheelchair with a little thing on it, and she had the crack rocks and their little individual wrappers up inside that wheelchair. And when somebody come along, she'd pull the little plug on the wheelchair and dispense however many. And that's how she was selling her crack cocaine out of her wheelchair. But they'll find a way.
You say that like it's a bad thing, Rick.
Look, it was. Social Security ain't what it used to be. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. At least we didn't have the foot chaser. On the positive side, there wasn't a foot chase involved in that one. It made it pretty easy. Yeah.
All I think of is that Seinfeld episode where George Costanza's in that motorized, scooter, and they're on the chase on the motorized scooters. But you said that was the first shooting. I mean, you were kind of like a ship magnet between Pittsburgh and here. So you had the shooting where you guys got the bad guy, but then the second one, the tables turned on you.
Yeah. So that was, you talked about the shit magnet thing. I know I've accused my mom a couple times of maybe like having, maybe a gypsy came in after she had me and I was in that little room where all the babies are in the little incubators and maybe I got like some kind of like gypsy blood curse, like even evil gypsy blood curse or something. But, So the next shooting, it happened about a year and 1 month to the date almost. And, the main justice, we had Janet Reno at the time. But they wanted us to do some things on the reservation. And I'll tell you, I felt really bad for the cops. There was regular uniform cops out there on the Yakima reservation and it's sprawling. I think Yakima is either the biggest or the second largest reservation, in the U.S. And we had only one investigator, the federal BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs. They had one special agent for that whole region. I mean, this guy had to cover, I think, Idaho, Washington and Oregon, just one guy. He's a really good guy too, but you can only do so much. But yeah, we end up looking into these guys that were selling dope on the reservation. Turned out they were former members of that American Indian movement. Back in the day, several years before that, they had killed a couple FBI guys somewhere over in, I don't know, Montana or what have you. But anyway, these two guys were known former members of that American Indian movement and whatever, but they were selling, and they had the uniform police, the Indian, the Yakima Indian, like uniform police, so afraid they wouldn't even hardly go on the road. I mean, these guys had weapons. And at a time before everybody having AK-47s, these guys, according to our informants, and they end up, it was true, these guys had weapons like crazy, AK-47s everywhere. Anyway, yeah, so they want us to go hit them. We let Maine Justice know through our ties, this is probably going to have a components of violence in it because these guys are known to be violent and whatever. And whoever, through Janet Reno or intermediaries, they said, go ahead and go do it. And so we went out there, we did some undercovers, and then we go to hit that place. And, you know, and I remember in the raid van, I tested, it's back when the weapon lights were still fairly new on your weapon. And they were incandescent bulbs. They weren't like the LEDs we have now. Tested the weapon in the car, the light on it, make sure, or in the raid van, everything's good to go. Of course, you come from the high mountain desert, sun's like crazy shining into a dark bad guy house, and the light popped. The minute we came in, I turned that light on, that weapon light popped. But yeah, we barely made entry. We made it through a mud room. And of course, we did our knock and announce and all that. Made it through a mud room. My partner, Jake, had a shield in front of me. And then it was me with a full auto M4. We make it through the door. We go to make a turn into this big great room. We're going to secure that while another guy with an automatic weapon secured a hallway. And then we're going to, you know, take our time for the hallway. And as soon as Jake got out there, he got stuck in the hallway. That a bunch of garbage was piled up. He couldn't get into that great room. Jake gets stopped up. And I know, like in Pittsburgh, whenever we were like going down long hallways, we'd go boot to boot, my partner and I, where one guy faces one way, their guy faces the other, because you don't know who's behind you, like going up steps in a tenement building. So I just did what came natural. I got behind Jake, put my boot up against his, and blocked that hallway until he could move. I didn't want to try to like lean around a corner. If I had to make a shot, make a bad shot, I figured me and my body armor behind Jake is a better option. So I got him, even though it's fatal funnel, you know, middle of a hallway. To me, because I'm right-handed, I couldn't have leaned around that wall and provide adequate cover for Jake. And also, this plays into it. We had just gotten our new lab vests. You know, all we had was a soft armor from before with no plates. And we finally, because we did a lot of labs, a lot of drug labs back in the 90s. But we got these new vests. And contrary to popular belief, DEA equipment sometimes is a long time in coming.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
When you get something really cool, you're like, this is great. But yeah, so I had a brand new vest. I mean, this vest still had that new car smell to it. And so I get into the hallway behind Jake, and I figure he's going to move. The minute I get there and I feel my boot touch his, this little short fella, it was one of our main bad guys, kind of a rotund little guy, Klingon looking kind of dude. He comes running out of a comical, like a kid that can't keep up with his feet. Like when they're running like downhill, a little kid that's like running before his feet is going to fall. You know, he's going to fall down. Well, this guy runs out of a back room like that, like comical, like he's drunk. Or whatever. He's got his arms and hands in front of him like he's trying not to fall down, one hand covering the other like he's trying not to fall down. I can't see a gun. It's pretty dark. I give him a couple commands as fast as you can. You know, please get down, whatever. He dives in the air. Like he's a short, squatty, little 5'5" dude, maybe, fat. But I'll tell you what, he had Jet Li moves on him. He goes across that hallway stumbling and then dives in the air. And as he dives, he moves his hand up from his other hand, and he's got a snub-nosed 357 Magnum. Boom. Instantly fires a round while he's in midair. And that round hit the wall, right next to my chest in the drywall of that hallway. And then the next round he fired as he's falling through the door, he fires one more. That one hits the wall right next to my head. And I end up getting shrapnel and whatever from that. And I also got part of a round in my vest, like dead center mass, right in my vest. We had begged DEA because we did a lot of warrants in Washington. I would say we averaged probably, I don't know, a dozen a week at least, because we helped all the other departments out. But because of all the entries, we wanted some type of eye protection. And the DEA, the SAC over there, is, I think his comment was, you kids watch too many movies or something. But we didn't get the eye protection. I will tell you, moving ahead a bit, after getting shot and getting shrapnel eye and wearing an eye patch for a couple weeks, they got us the eye protection from this one. But yeah, so back to the shoot. I know I've been hit because I can't see out of my left eye. It's all mucked up and whatever, but I know where that guy's going to shoot at me from again. Turns out he shot a third round, but that round went into the door jamb and then kind of got stuck in the studs. But, I knew where he was going to, I just knew he was going to roll back out, because I would roll back out and launch the rest of them. So I point in right where on that corner of the wall. And I have to add too, there were no other houses in vicinity. We're up in the high mountain desert. These people had no neighbors. There were no children. There were no innocents in this house. It was a bad dude house. The closest other house was miles away. So knowing that, but anyway, yeah. So I aim right for where I know he's just going to roll out of there. And I just go to town, and I gave him full auto And I shot a lot of full auto, both short bursts and long bursts in practice, years and years and years of it. And so I aimed in, I got on him, and it was really, the burst was like maybe 4 inches, 5 inches tall, and it was a Z, like Zorro in the wall. But I just zipped him on that wall where I thought he was. And luckily for that guy, what protected him mostly was an old, like one of those steel claw bathtubs. You know, the bathtubs is old school with the big claw feet on them, whatever, made out of like, I don't know if it's made out of like galvanized steel or something. But he took one round across the boobs, man boobs. He had like, kind of like, you know, being a little bit chubbier, he had like the man boobs. And so nothing vital, just a bunch of like, you know, baby fat, whatever. But yeah, so one of the rounds went through. That took the spunk out of him and what have you, but went full auto. And then one of the things that Quantico is very good about when they're training, we have role players, we have simunitions, we shoot each other up in like what you'd call like the shoot houses and the raid houses, simulate real operations. Even the rest out on the road, they have real role players and actors. But this is one of those ones where they would have had to have a pretty big budget to be able to simulate this one. So full auto, blah, blah, blah. The entire hallway fills up with drywall dust. So you can't see 6 feet down the hall. The smoke alarms all go off. So now that's all screaming. And then you know you've hit pay dirt, because from the back room, it's a man's voice, but it's like screaming like in falsetto, like, ah, I mean, just like really high pitch. You definitely hit something. And luckily, I mean, like once in a while, the good guys get lucky. We had a state trooper down the road from our house blocking off an intersection, because they're not allowed to come on the reservation to do enforcement, but he's allowed to like block off a road because you're basically like in a foreign country almost when you're on arrest. But we had a state trooper about 150 yards down the road at an intersection, and it's all high mountain desert. So he's out there in the clear 150, 200 yards away. Well, aside from hitting the guy that was in, you know, the guy that took the shot, there was in the back room, you could tell what this fella had done. He had picked up a 300 Winchester Magnum bolt action rifle. The round was almost into the chamber, like the bolt's forward, getting ready to be racked down, scoped rifle. And you could look right out the window and see that trooper down there 200 yards away. And 200 yards is nothing for a 300
Winchester rifle. Wow. Doesn't even drop. Yeah.
But luckily, luckily, the only round that went into his room, because he's in the room behind that bathroom, everything else got stopped by the tub, by a big oak cabinet. One round went all the way through everything. And you could have been the Irish Republican Army with somebody that you wanted to kneecap with a pistol sitting tied up in a chair in front of you, and you would had to hold still, don't move, to make that kneecap shot. But that round went through both of his kneecaps, went through both knees like he'd meant to do it, and that was the instant gratification of the screaming where you knew you hit something. But yeah, that round went through both of that guy's knees. He folded up like a deck of cards and whatever, and he was more than happy to crawl out to us. Which is, I mean, it was like one of the scenes from a zombie movie where the zombie's coming at you because he can't use his back legs or whatever, they're gone or they're whatever. He come crawl up that hallway to us when we called him out. But in the end, yeah, we went through the rest of the house, had people hiding. There were a couple other bad guys that tried to hide under stacks of clothes and what have you. And you see like a trembling stack of clothes and there's somebody in there. But that was the second one. I survived it just fine. I had an abrased cornea, I think, or something. It wasn't a permanent deal. Healed within a week or two. It's like scratchy. It felt like if you'd scratch your eye pretty bad. But yeah, so that was the second.
Hey, Rick, we're going to do something this is truly something we haven't done before. We've brought people back to say, well, we've only brought one person back, and that was Mundo, a Mexican mafia guy. You've got so much stuff. What we're going to do is we're going to make this part one, because in part two, there's some really good stuff. We've seen the picture. Let's not go into the story, but just tell, how many pounds was that grizzly?
Probably about 750 to 800 pounds.
So we have a grizzly. Damn.
Damn. He's a refrigerator. Basically a refrigerator with hair and teeth and claws. Yeah.
So we got a grizzly story. We got stories about St. Croix, because you go from one extreme to the other, my man. You go from hanging out in beach shorts and thongs and, you know, flip-flop sandals and everything else in St. Croix to you go to Alaska. So we're going to have to get into that. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring this to a close right here. We'll make this part one. And then part two, we're going to start off with the grizzly story, because I've seen the picture, Murph's seen the picture. We want to know how you did it. I mean, let's save it for the part two, but yeah. I'm telling you, when you see this picture, if you were, you talk about, remember the guy that had the doo-doo in his pants? I want to know if you had doo-doo in your pants after this one. So, but don't tell anybody, that's our tease. Yeah. We're going to save this for part two. So we're not saying goodbye right now, but what we're going to do is say stand by, because this is the end of part. So we have part one and two of part one, and then we'll have part three and part four of the next episode. So don't go anywhere. You guys hang on. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. Can you believe we haven't even got to a lot of the good parts yet?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the guys out there, he took a round to the chest. Thank God he had his bulletproof vest on, saved his life.
Rambo, yeah. You know what? He gives a whole new meaning to Donkey Kong.
Yeah, I'm not going there.
Oh, my God. I got to tell you, did not see that one coming when he just went.
Yep.
That big. And then, but his moose call, though. I enjoyed his moose call.
And Rick, thank you for doing that, brother.
Hey, well, look, there's still a lot more to come. So next week, we start off with the Grizzly story and St. Croix, and we get into some pretty wicked stuff, including some attempts on people's lives. I mean, you would think nothing happens down in St. Croix. Just you hang on, friends, because we're going to disabuse you of that notion that St. Croix is this peaceful little island mine with nothing going on, because there was shit going on. But
absolutely,
we're going to find out about that next week, all right? So thank you, guys. Everybody hang tight. This is the end of part two, and we will come out with part three next Monday. But thank you guys once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.